The Two Towers. Disc 8.
Theoden opened his mouth as if to speak, but he said nothing. He looked up at the face of Saruman with its dark, solemn eyes bent down upon him, and then to Gandalf at his side, and he seemed to hesitate. Gandalf made no sign, but stood silent as stone, as one waiting patiently for some call that has not yet come. The rider stirred at first, murmuring with approval of the words of Saruman, and then they too were silent, as men spellbound. It seemed to them that Gandalf had never spoken so fair and fittingly to their lord. Rough and proud now seemed all his dealings with Theoden, and over their hearts crept a shadow, the fear of a great danger, the end of the mark in a darkness to which Gandalf was driving them, while Saruman stood beside a door of escape, holding it half open, so that a ray of light came through. There was a heavy silence. It was Gimli the dwarf who broke it suddenly.
"The words of this wizard stand on their heads," he growled, gripping the handle of his axe. "In the language of Orthonk, help means ruin, and saving means slaying. That is plain. But we don't come here to beg."
"Peace," said Saruman, and for a fleeting moment his voice was less suave, and a light flickered in his eyes and was gone.
"I do not speak to you yet, Gimli Gloin's son," he said. "Far away is your home, and small concern of yours are the troubles of this land. But it was not by design of your own that you became embroiled in them, and so I will not blame such part as you have played, a valiant one, I doubt not. But I pray you, allow me first to speak with the King of Rohan, my neighbour, and once my friend. What have you to say, Theoden King? Will you have peace with me, and all the aid that my knowledge, founded in long years, can bring? Shall we make our counsels together against evil days, and repair our injuries with such good will that our estate shall both come to fairer flower than ever before?"
Still Theoden did not answer. Whether he strove with anger or doubt, none could say. Éomer spoke.
"Lord, hear me," he said. "Now we feel the peril that we were warned of. Have we ridden forth to victory, only to stand at last amazed by an old liar with honey on his forked tongue? So would the trapped wolf speak to the hounds if he could. What aid can he give to you, forsooth? All he desires is to escape from his plight. But will you parley with this dealer in treachery and murder? Remember Theodred at the fords, and the grave of Harmer in Helm's Deep." "If we speak of poisoned tongues, what shall we say of yours, young serpent?" said Saruman, and the flash of his anger was now plain to see. "But come, Éomer, Éomund's son," he went on in his soft voice again, "to every man his part. Valour in arms is yours, and you win high honour thereby. Slay whom your lord names as enemies, and be content. Meddle not in policies which you don't understand. But maybe, if you become a king, you'll find that he must choose his friends with care. The friends of Saruman and the power of Orthonk cannot be lightly thrown aside, whatever grievances, real or fancied, may lie behind. You've won a battle, but not a war, and that with help on which you cannot count again. But you may find the shadow of the wood at your own door next. It is wayward and senseless, and has no love for men. But, my lord of Rohan, am I to be called a murderer, because valiant men have fallen in battle? If you go to war, needlessly, for I didn't desire it, then men will be slain. But if I'm a murderer on that account, then all the house of Eol is stained with murder, for they've fought many wars, and assailed many who defied them. Yet with some they've afterwards made peace, none the worse for being politic. I say, Theoden King, shall we have peace and friendship, you and I? It is ours to command."
"We will have peace," said Theoden at last, thickly and with an effort.
Several of the riders cried out gladly. Theoden held up his hand.
"Yes, we will have peace," he said, now in a clear voice. "We will have peace,
when you and all your works have perished, and the works of your dark master to whom you would deliver us? You're a liar, Saruman, and a corrupter of men's hearts. You hold out your hand to me, and I perceive only a finger of the claw of Mordor, cruel and cold. Even if your war on me was just, as it was not. For were you 10 times as wise, you would have no right to rule me and mine for your own profit as you desired. Even so, what will you say of your tortures in Westfold, and the children that lie dead there? And they hewed Harmer's body before the gates of the Hornburg, after he was dead? When you hang from a gibbet at your window for the sport of your own crows, I will have peace with you and Orthanc. So much for the House of Aeol. A lesser son of great sires am I, but I don't need to lick your fingers. Turn elsewhither, but I fear your voice has lost its charm.
The riders gazed up at Theoden like men startled out of a dream. Harsh as an old raven's, their master's voice sounded in their ears after the music of Saruman. But Saruman for a while was beside himself with wrath. He leaned over the rail as if he would smite the king with a staff. To some, suddenly, it seemed that they saw a snake coiling itself to strike.
"Gibbets and crows!" he hissed, and they shuddered at the hideous change. "Dotard! What is the House of Aeol but a thatched barn where brigands drink in the reek and their brats roll on the floor among the dogs? Too long have they escaped the gibbet themselves, but the noose cubs, slowly in the drawing, tight and hard in the end. Hang if you will!"
Now his voice changed, and he slowly mastered himself.
"I know not why I have had the patience to speak to you, for I need you not, nor your little band of gallopers, as swift to fly as to advance, Theoden Horsemaster. Long ago I offered you a state beyond your merit and your wit. I've offered it again, so that those whom you mislead may clearly see the choice of roads. You give me brag and abuse, so be it. Go back to your huts. But you, Gandalf, for you at least I'm grieved, feeling for your shame. How comes it that you can endure such company? For you are proud, Gandalf, and not without reason, having a noble mind and eyes that look both deep and far. Even now will you not listen to my counsel?" Gandalf stirred and looked up. "What have you to say that you didn't say at our last meeting?" he asked. "Or perhaps you have things to unsay?"
Saruman paused.
"Unsay?" he mused, as if puzzled. "Unsay? I endeavoured to advise you for your own good, but you scarcely listened. You're proud and don't love advice, having indeed a store of your own wisdom. But on that occasion you erred, I think, misconstruing my intentions wilfully. I fear that in my eagerness to persuade you I lost patience. And indeed I regret it, for I bore you no ill will, and even now I bear none, though you return to me in the company of the violent and the ignorant. How should I? Are we not both members of a high and ancient order, most excellent in Middle-earth? Our friendship would profit us both alike. Much we could still accomplish together to heal the disorders of the world. Let us understand one another, and dismiss from thought these lesser folk. Let them wait on our decisions. For the common good I'm willing to redress the past and to receive you. Will you not consult with me? Will you not come up?"
So great was the power that Saruman exerted in this last effort that none that stood within hearing were unmoved. But now the spell was wholly different. They heard the gentle remonstrance of a kindly king with an erring but much-loved minister. But they were shut out, listening at a door to words not meant for them, ill-mannered children or stupid servants overhearing the elusive discourse of their elders and wondering how it could affect their lot. Of loftier mould these two were made, reverend and wise. It was inevitable that they should make an alliance. Gandalf would ascend into the tower to discuss deep things beyond their comprehension in the high chambers of Orthanc. The door would be closed, and they would be left outside, dismissed to await allotted work or punishment. Even in the mind of Theoden, the thought took shape, like a shadow of doubt.
He will betray us. He will go. We shall be lost.
Then Gandalf laughed. The fantasy vanished like a puff of smoke.
Saruman! Saruman! Said Gandalf, still laughing. Saruman, you missed your path in life. You should have been the king's jester and earned your bread and stripes too by mimicking his counsellors. Ah, me!
He paused, getting the better of his mirth.
Understand one another. I fear I'm beyond your comprehension. But you, Saruman, I understand now too well. I keep a clearer memory of your arguments and deeds than you suppose. When last I visited you, you were the jailer of Mordor, and there I was to be sent. Nay, the guest who has escaped from the roof will think twice before he comes back in by the door. Nay, I don't think I will come up. But listen, Saruman, for the last time, will you not come down? Isengard has proved less strong than your hope and fancy made it. So may other things in which you still have trust. Would it not be well to leave it for a while? To turn to a new thing, perhaps? Think well, Saruman. Will you not come down?
A shadow passed over Saruman's face. Then it went deathly white. Before he could conceal it, they saw through the mask the anguish of a mind in doubt, loathing to stay and dreading to leave its refuge. For a second he hesitated, and no one breathed. Then he spoke, and his voice was shrill and cold. Pride and hate were conquering him. "Will I come down?" he mocked. "Does an unarmed man come down to speak with robbers out of doors? I can hear you well enough here. I'm no fool, and I don't trust you, Gandalf. They don't stand openly on my stairs, but I know where the wildwood demons are lurking, at your command."
"The treacherous are ever distrustful," answered Gandalf wearily. "But you needn't fear for your skin. I don't wish to kill you or hurt you. As you would know if you really understood me, and I have the power to protect you, I am giving you a last chance. You can leave Orthonk free if you choose."
"That sounds well," sneered Saruman. "Very much in the manner of Gandalf the Great, so condescending and so very kind. I don't doubt that you would find Orthonk commodious, and my departure convenient, but why should I wish to leave? And what do you mean by free? There are conditions, I presume."
"Reasons for leaving you can see from your windows," answered Gandalf. "Others will occur to your thought. Your servants are destroyed and scattered. Your neighbours you have made your enemies. And you have cheated your new master, or tried to do so. When his eye turns hither, it will be the red eye of wrath. But when I say free, I mean free. Free from bond, of chain or command. To go where you will, even to Mordor, Saruman, if you desire. But you will first surrender to me the key of Orthonk, and your staff. They shall be pledges of your conduct, to be returned later, if you merit them."
Saruman's face grew livid, twisted with rage, and a red light was kindled in his eyes. He laughed wildly.
"Later!" he cried, and his voice rose to a scream. "Later! Yes, when you also have the keys of Barad-dûr itself, I suppose, and the crowns of 7 kings, and the rods of the 5 wizards, and have purchased yourself a pair of boots many sizes larger than those that you wear now. A modest plan, hardly one in which my help is needed. I have other things to do. Don't be a fool. If you wish to treat with me, while you have a chance, go away and come back when you're sober, and leave behind these cutthroats and small ragtag that dangle at your tail. Good day."
He turned and left the balcony.
"Come back, Saruman," said Gandalf in a commanding voice.
To the amazement of the others, Saruman turned again, and as if dragged against his will, he came slowly back to the iron rail, leaning on it, breathing hard. His face was lined and shrunken. His hand clutched his heavy black staff like a claw.
"I didn't give you leave to go," said Gandalf sternly. "I have not finished. You have become a fool, Saruman, and yet pitiable. You might still have turned away from folly and evil, and have been of service. But you choose to stay and gnaw the ends of your old plots. Stay, then, but I warn you. You won't easily come out again.
"'Not unless the dark hands of the East stretch out to take you, Saruman,' he cried, and his voice grew in power and authority. "'Behold, I am not Gandalf the Grey, whom you betrayed. I am Gandalf the White, who has returned from death. You have no colour now, and I cast you from the Order and from the Council.'
He raised his hand, and spoke slowly in a clear, cold voice.
"'Saruman, your staff is broken!'
There was a crack, and the staff split asunder in Saruman's hand, and the head of it fell down at Gandalf's feet.
"'Go!'
said Gandalf. With a cry, Saruman fell back and crawled away. At that moment a heavy shining thing came hurtling down from above. It glanced off the iron rail, even as Saruman left it, and passing close to Gandalf's head, it smote the stair on which he stood. The rail rang and snapped. The stair cracked and splintered in glittering sparks. But the ball was unharmed. It rolled on down the steps, a globe of crystal, dark, but glowing with a heart of fire. As it bounded away towards a pool, Pippin ran after it and picked it up.
"'The murderous rogue!'
cried Éomer. But Gandalf was unmoved.
"'No, that was not thrown by Saruman,' he said. "'Nor even at his bidding, I think. It came from a window far above, a parting shot from Master Wormtongue, I fancy.' But ill-aimed. The aim was poor, maybe, because he couldn't make up his mind which he hated more, you or Saruman, said Aragorn. That may be so, said Gandalf. Small comfort will those two have in their companionship. They will gnaw one another with words, but the punishment is just. If Wormtongue ever comes out of Orthanc alive, it will be more than he deserves. Here, my lad, I'll take that. I didn't ask you to handle it.
He cried, turning sharply and seeing Pippin coming up the steps, slowly, as if he were bearing a great weight.
He went down to meet him and hastily took the dark globe from the hobbit, wrapping it in the folds of his cloak. "'I'll take care of this,' he said. "'It's not a thing, I guess, that Saruman would have chosen to cast away.' "'But he may have other things to cast,' said Gimli. "'If that's the end of the debate, let's go out of Stone's Throw at least.' "'It is the end,' said Gandalf. "'Let us go.'
They turned their backs on the doors of Orthanc and went down. The riders hailed the king with joy and saluted Gandalf. The spell of Saruman was broken. They had seen him come at call and crawl away, dismissed.
"'Well, that's done,' said Gandalf. "'Now I must find Treebeard and tell him how things have gone.'
"'He'll have guessed, surely,' said Merry. Were they likely to end any other way?
Not likely, answered Gandalf, though they came to the balance of a hair. But I had reasons for trying, some merciful and some less so. First Saruman was shown that the power of his voice was waning. He cannot be both tyrant and counsellor. When the plot is ripe, it remains no longer secret. Yet he fell into the trap, and tried to deal with his victims piecemeal, while others listened. Then I gave him a last choice and a fair one, to renounce both Mordor and his private schemes, and make amends by helping us in our need. He knows our need, none better. Great service he could have rendered, but he's chosen to withhold it and keep the power of Orthanc. He will not serve, only command.
He lives now in terror of the shadow of Mordor, and yet he still dreams of riding the storm.
Unhappy fool! He'll be devoured if the power of the East stretches out its arms to Isengard. We can't destroy Orthanc from without, but Sauron, who knows what he can do?
And what if Sauron doesn't conquer? What will you do to him? Asked Pippin.
I? Nothing, said Gandalf. I won't do anything to him. I don't wish for mastery. What will become of him, I can't say. I grieve that so much that was good now festers in the tower. Still, for us, things have not gone badly. Strange are the turns of fortune. Often does hatred hurt itself. I guess that, even if we had entered in, we could have found new treasures in Orthanc more precious than the thing which Wormtongue threw down at us.
A shrill shriek, suddenly cut off, came from an open window high above.
It seems that Saruman thinks so too, said Gandalf. Let's leave them.
They returned now to the ruins of the gate. Hardly had they passed out under the arch, when, from under the shadows of the piled stones where they had stood, Treebeard and a dozen other Ents came striding up. Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas gazed at them in wonder.
"Here are three of my companions, Treebeard," said Gandalf. "I've spoken of them, but you haven't yet seen them." He named them one by one.
The old Ent looked at them long and searchingly, and spoke to them in turn. Last he came to Legolas.
"So you have come all the way from Mirkwood, my good elf? A very great forest it used to be."
"And still is," said Legolas, "but not so great that we who dwell there ever tire of seeing new trees. I should dearly love to journey in Fangorn's wood. I scarcely passed beyond the eaves of it, and I didn't wish to turn back." Treebeard's eyes gleamed with pleasure.
"I hope you may have your wish ere the hills be much older," he said.
"I'll come, if I have the fortune," said Legolas. "I've made a bargain with my friend that, if all goes well, we'll visit Fangorn together, by your leave."
"Any elf that comes with you will be welcome," said Treebeard.
"The friend I speak of isn't an elf," said Legolas. "I mean Gimli, Gloin's son here." Gimli bowed low, and the axe slipped from his belt and clattered on the ground.
"No," said Treebeard, looking dark-eyed at him. "A dwarf and an axe-bearer? I have goodwill to elves, but you ask much. This is a strange friendship."
"Strange it may seem," said Legolas, "but while Gimli lives, I shall not come to Fangorn alone. His axe is not for trees, but for Orcnecks, O Fangorn, master of Fangorn's wood. 42 he hewed in the battle."
"Ho! Come now," said Treebeard, "that's a better story. Well, well, things will go as they will, and there's no need to hurry to meet them. But now we must part for a while. Day is drawing to an end, yet Gandalf says you must go ere nightfall, and the Lord of the Mark is eager for his own house."
"Yes, we must go, and go now," said Gandalf. "I fear that I must take your gatekeepers from you, but you'll manage well enough without them."
"Maybe I shall," said Treebeard, "but I shall miss them. We've become friends in so short a while that I think I must be getting hasty, growing backwards towards youth, perhaps. But they're the first new thing under sun or moon that I've seen for many a long, long day. I shan't forget them. I've put their names into the long list. Ents will remember it. Ents the earth-born, old as mountains, the wide-walkers, water-drinking, and hungry as hunters, the hobbit-children, the laughing-folk, the little people. They shall remain friends as long as leaves are renewed. Fare you well. But if you hear news up in your pleasant land, in the Shire, send me word. You know what I mean, word or sight of the Entwives. Come yourselves if you can."
"We will," said Merry and Pippin together, and they turned away hastily. Treebeard looked at them and was silent for a while, shaking his head thoughtfully. Then he turned to Gandalf.
"So Saruman would not leave," he said. "I did not think he would. His heart is as rotten as a black horn's. Still, if I were overcome and all my trees destroyed, I would not come while I had one dark hole left to hide in."
"No," said Gandalf, "but you've not plotted to cover all the world with your trees and choke all other living things. But there it is. Saruman remains to nurse his hatred and weave again such webs as he can. He has the key of Orthanc, but he must not be allowed to escape."
"Indeed, no. Ents will see to that," said Treebeard. "Saruman shall not set foot beyond the rock without my leave. Ents will watch over him."
"Good," said Gandalf. "That is what I hoped. Now I can go and turn to other matters with one care the less. But you must be wary. The waters have gone down.
It will not be enough to put sentinels round the tower, I fear. I don't doubt that there were deep ways delved under Orthanc, and that Saruman hopes to go and come unmarked before long. If you will undertake the labour, I beg you to pour in the waters again, and do so until Isengard remains a standing pool, or you discover the outlets. When all the underground places are drowned, and the outlets blocked, then Saruman must stay upstairs and look out of the windows.
"Leave it to the Ents," said Treebeard. "We shall search the valley from head to foot and peer under every pebble. Trees are coming back to live here. Old trees, wild trees, the Watchwood we will call it. Not a squirrel will go here, but I shall know of it. Leave it to Ents. Until 7 times the years in which he tormented us have passed, we shall not tire of watching him."
Chapter 11. The Palantir. The sun was shining behind the long western arm of the mountains when Gandalf and his companions, and the king with his riders, set out again from Isengard. Gandalf took Merry behind him, and Aragorn took Pippin. Two of the king's men went on ahead, riding swiftly, and passed soon out of sight down into the valley. The others followed at an easy pace. Ents in a solemn row stood like statues at the gate, with their long arms uplifted, but they made no sound. Merry and Pippin looked back when they had passed some way down the winding road. Sunlight was still shining in the sky, but long shadows reached over Isengard, grey ruins falling into darkness. Treebeard stood alone there now, like the distant stump of an old tree. The hobbits thought of their first meeting, upon the sunny ledge, far away on the borders of Fangorn. They came to the pillar of the White Hand. The pillar was still standing, but the graven hand had been thrown down and broken into small pieces. Right in the middle of the road the long forefinger lay, white in the dusk, its red nail darkening to black.
"The Ents pay attention to every detail," said Gandalf.
They rode on, and evening deepened in the valley.
"Are we riding far tonight, Gandalf?" asked Merry after a while.
"I don't know how you feel with small ragtag dangling behind you, but the ragtag is tired and will be glad to stop dangling and lie down."
"So you heard that," said Gandalf. "Don't let it rankle. Be thankful no longer words were aimed at you. He had his eyes on you. If it is any comfort to your pride, I should say that, at the moment, you and Pippin are more in his thoughts than all the rest of us. Who you are, how you came there, and why, what you know, whether you were captured, and if so, how you escaped when all the orcs perished. It is with those little riddles that the great mind of Saruman is troubled. A sneer from him, Merry Arduk, is a compliment, if you feel honoured by his concern."
"Thank you," said Merry. "But it's a greater honour to dangle at your tail, Gandalf. For one thing, in that position one has a chance of putting a question a second time. Are we riding far tonight?" Gandalf laughed.
"A most unquenchable hobbit. All wizards should have a hobbit or two in their care, to teach them the meaning of the word, and to correct them. I beg your pardon, but I have given thought even to these simple matters. We will ride for a few hours, gently, until we come to the end of the valley. Tomorrow we must ride faster. When we came, we meant to go straight from Isengard back to the king's house at Edoras over the plains, a ride of some days. But we've taken thought and changed the plan. Messengers have gone ahead to Helm's Deep, to warn them that the king is returning tomorrow. He'll ride from there with many men to Dunharrow by paths among the hills. From now on, no more than 2 or 3 together are to go openly over the land, by day or night, when it can be avoided."
"Nothing or a double helping is your way," said Merry. "I'm afraid I wasn't looking beyond tonight's bed. Where and what are Helm's Deep and all the rest of it? I don't know anything about this country."
"Then you'd best learn something, if you wish to understand what's happening. But not just now, and not from me. I've too many pressing things to think about."
"All right, I'll tackle Strider by the campfire. He's less testy. But why all this secrecy? I thought we'd won the battle."
"Yes, we've won.
but only the first victory, and that in itself increases our danger. There was some link between Isengard and Mordor, which I've not yet fathomed. How they exchanged news I'm not sure, but they did so. The Eye of Barad-dûr will be looking impatiently towards the Wizard Vale, I think, and towards Rohan. The less it sees, the better. The road passed slowly, winding down the valley. Now further, and now nearer, Isen flowed in its stony bed. Night came down from the mountains. All the mists were gone. A chill wind blew. The moon, now waxing round, filled the eastern sky with a pale, cold sheen. The shoulders of the mountain to their right sloped down to bare hills. The wide plains opened grey before them. At last they halted. Then they turned aside, leaving the highway and taking to the sweet upland turf again. Going westward a mile or so, they came to a dale. It opened southward, leaning back into the slope of round Dol Baran, the last hill of the northern ranges, green-footed, crowned with heather. The sides of the glen were shaggy with last year's bracken, among which the tight-curled fronds of spring were just thrusting through the sweet-scented earth. Thorn bushes grew thick upon the low banks, and under them they made their camp, 2 hours or so before the middle of the night. They lit a fire in a hollow, down among the roots of a spreading hawthorn, tall as a tree, writhen with age, but hale in every limb. Buds were swelling at each twig's tip. Guards were set, 2 at a watch. The rest, after they had supped, wrapped themselves in a cloak and blanket and slept. The hobbits lay in a corner by themselves upon a pile of old bracken. Merry was sleepy, but Pippin now seemed curiously restless. The bracken cracked and rustled as he twisted and turned. "What's the matter?" asked Merry. "Are you lying on an anthill?" "No," said Pippin, "but I'm not comfortable. I wonder how long it is since I slept in a bed." Merry yawned. "Work it out on your fingers," he said. "But you must know how long it is since we left Lorien." "Oh, that," said Pippin. "I mean a real bed in a bedroom." "Well, Rivendell, then," said Merry. "But I could sleep anywhere tonight." "You had the luck, Merry," said Pippin softly, after a long pause. "You were riding with Gandalf." "Well, what of it?" "Did you get any news, any information out of him?"
"Yes, a good deal, more than usual. But you heard it all, or most of it. You were close by, and we were talking no secrets. But you can go with him tomorrow, if you think you'll get more out of him, and if he'll have you."
"Can I? Good. But he's close, isn't he? Not changed at all?"
"Oh, yes, he is," said Merry, waking up a little, and beginning to wonder what was bothering his companion. "He has grown, or something. He can be both kinder and more alarming, merrier and more solemn than before, I think. He's changed, but we've not had a chance to see him much yet. But think of the last part of that business with Saruman. Remember Saruman was once Gandalf's superior, head of the council, whatever that may be exactly. He was Saruman the White. Gandalf is the White now. Saruman came when he was told, and his rod was taken. And then he was just told to go, and he went."
"Well, if Gandalf has changed at all, then he's closer than ever, that's all," Pippin argued. "That glass ball, now. He seemed mighty pleased with it.
He knows or guesses something about it. But does he tell us what?"
"No, not a word. Yet I picked it up, and I saved it from rolling into a pool."
"Here, I'll take that, my lad. That's all.
I wonder what it is. It felt so very heavy."
Pippin's voice fell very low, as if he was talking to himself. "Hallo," said Merry. "So that's what is bothering you. Now, Pippin, my lad, don't forget Gildor's saying, the one Sam used to quote, 'Do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, for they are subtle and quick to anger.'
But our whole life for months has been one long meddling in the affairs of wizards," said Pippin. "I should like a bit of information as well as danger. I should like a look at that ball."
"Go to sleep," said Merry. "You'll get information enough sooner or later. My dear Pippin,
No took ever beat a brandy buck for inquisitiveness. But is this the time, I ask you? All right. What's the harm in my telling you what I should like? A look at that stone.
I know I can't have it, with old Gandalf sitting on it, like a hen on an egg. But it doesn't help much to get no more from you than a you can't have it, so go to sleep.
Well, what else could I say? Said Mary. I'm sorry, Pippin, but you really must wait till the morning. I'll be as curious as you like after breakfast, and I'll help in any way I can at wizard wheedling. But I can't keep awake any longer. If I yawn any more, I shall split at the ears. Good night.
Pippin said no more. He lay still now, but sleep remained far away, and it was not encouraged by the sound of Merry breathing softly, asleep in a few minutes after saying good night. The thought of the dark globe seemed to grow stronger as all grew quiet. Pippin felt again its weight in his hands, and saw again the mysterious red depths into which he had looked for a moment. He tossed and turned and tried to think of something else. At last he could stand it no longer. He got up and looked round. It was chilly, and he wrapped his cloak about him. The moon was shining cold and white, down into the dell, and the shadows of the bushes were black. All about lay sleeping shapes. The two guards were not in view. They were up on the hill, perhaps, or hidden in the bracken. Driven by some impulse that he did not understand, Pippin walked softly to where Gandalf lay. He looked down at him. The wizard seemed asleep, but with lids not fully closed. There was a glitter of eyes under his long lashes. Pippin stepped back hastily, but Gandalf made no sign, and drawn forward once more, half against his will, the hobbit crept up again from behind the wizard's head. He was rolled in a blanket, with his cloak spread over the top and close beside him. Between his right side and his bent arm there was a hummock, something round wrapped in a dark cloth. His hand seemed only just to have slipped off it to the ground. Hardly breathing, Pippin crept nearer, foot by foot. At last he knelt down. Then he put his hands out stealthily and slowly lifted the lump up. It didn't seem quite so heavy as he'd expected. "Only some bundle of oddments, perhaps, after all," he thought with a strange sense of relief. But he didn't put the bundle down again. He stood for a moment clasping it. Then an idea came into his mind. He tiptoed away, found a large stone, and came back. Quickly now he drew off the cloth, wrapped the stone in it, and kneeling down, laid it back by the wizard's hand. Then at last he looked at the thing that he had uncovered. There it was, a smooth globe of crystal, now dark and dead, lying bare before his knees. Pippin lifted it, covered it hurriedly in his own cloak, and half turned to go back to his bed. At that moment Gandalf moved in his sleep, and muttered some words. They seemed to be in a strange tongue. His hand groped out and clasped the wrapped stone. Then he sighed and did not move again. "You idiotic fool," Pippin muttered to himself. "You're going to get yourself into frightful trouble. Put it back quick." But he found now that his knees quaked, and he didn't dare to go near enough to the wizard to reach the bundle. "I'll never get it back now without waking him," he thought. "Not till I'm a bit calmer. So I may as well have a look first. Not just here, though." He stole away, and sat down on a green hillock not far from his bed. The moon looked in over the edge of the dell. Pippin sat with his knees drawn up and the ball between them. He bent low over it, looking like a greedy child stooped over a bowl of food in a corner away from others. He drew his cloak aside and gazed at it. The air seemed still and tense about him. At first the globe was dark, black as jet, with a moonlight gleaming on its surface. Then there came a faint glow and stir in the heart of it, and it held his eyes, so that now he could not look away. Soon all the inside seemed on fire, the ball was spinning, or the lights within were revolving. Suddenly the lights went out. He gave a gasp and struggled, but he remained bent, clasping the ball with both hands. Closer and closer he bent, and then became rigid, His lips moved soundlessly for a while. Then, with a strangled cry, he fell back and lay still. The cry was piercing. The guards leapt down from the banks. All the camp was soon astir.
"So this is the thief," said Gandalf.
Hastily he cast his cloak over the globe where it lay.
"But you, Pippin, this is a grievous turn to things."
He knelt by Pippin's body. The hobbit was lying on his back, rigid, with unseeing eyes staring up at the sky.
"The devilry! What mischief has he done, to himself and to all of us?"
The wizard's face was drawn and haggard. He took Pippin's hand and bent over his face, listening for his breath. Then he laid his hands on his brow. The hobbit shuddered. His eyes closed. He cried out and sat up, staring in bewilderment at all the faces round him, pale in the moonlight.
"It's not for you, Saruman,"
he cried in a shrill and toneless voice, shrinking away from Gandalf.
"I will send for it at once. Do you understand? Say just that."
Then he struggled to get up and escape, but Gandalf held him gently and firmly.
"Peregrin took," he said. "Come back."
The hobbit relaxed and fell back, clinging to the wizard's hand.
"Gandalf," he cried. "Gandalf, forgive me."
"Forgive you?" said the wizard. "Tell me first what you've done."
I took the ball and looked at it," stammered Pippin, "and I saw things that frightened me, and I wanted to go away, but I couldn't. And then he came and questioned me, and he looked at me, and that is all I remember."
"That won't do," said Gandalf sternly. "What did you see, and what did you say?"
Pippin shut his eyes and shivered, but said nothing. They all stared at him in silence, except Merry, who turned away. But Gandalf's face was still hard.
"Speak," he said. In a low, hesitating voice, Pippin began again, and slowly his words grew clearer and stronger.
"I saw a dark sky and tall battlements," he said, "and tiny stars. It seemed very far away and long ago, yet hard and clear. Then the stars went in and out. They were cut off by things with wings, very big, I think, really. But in the glass they looked like bats wheeling round the tower. I thought there were 9 of them. One began to fly straight towards me, getting bigger and bigger. It had a horrible... No, I can't say. I tried to get away, because I thought it would fly out. But when it had covered all the globe, it disappeared. Then he came.
He didn't speak so that I could hear words. He just looked, and I understood." "So you have come back. Why have you neglected to report for so long?"
"I didn't answer."
"He said, 'Who are you?'"
"I still didn't answer, but it hurt me horribly. And he pressed me, so I said, 'A hobbit.' Then suddenly he seemed to see me, and he laughed at me. It was cruel. It was like being stabbed with knives. I struggled, but he said,
'Wait a moment. We shall meet again soon. Tell Saruman that this dainty is not for him. I will send for it at once. Do you understand? Say just that.'
Then he gloated over me. I felt I was falling to pieces. No, I can't say any more. I don't remember anything else."
"Look at me," said Gandalf.
Pippin looked up straight into his eyes. The wizard held his gaze for a moment in silence. Then his face grew gentler, and the shadow of a smile appeared. He laid his hand softly on Pippin's head.
"All right," he said. "Say no more. You've taken no harm. There's no lie in your eyes, as I feared. But he didn't speak long with you. A fool, but an honest man, you remain, Peregrin Took. Wiser ones might have done worse in such a pass. But mark this. You've been saved, and all your friends too, mainly by good fortune, as it's called. You can't count on it a second time. If he'd questioned you, then and there, almost certainly you would have told all that you know, to the ruin of us all. But he was too eager. He didn't want information only. He wanted you, quickly, so that he could deal with you in the Dark Tower, slowly. Don't shudder. If you will meddle in the affairs of wizards, you must be prepared to think of such things. But come, I forgive you. Be comforted. Things have not turned out as evilly as they might."
He lifted Pippin gently and carried him back to his bed. Merry followed and sat beside him.
"Lie there and rest if you can, Pippin.
said Gandalf. "Trust me. If you feel an itch in your palms again, tell me of it. Such things can be cured. But anyway, my dear hobbit, don't put a lump of rock under my elbow again. Now I'll leave you two together for a while."
With that, Gandalf returned to the others, who were still standing by the Orthanc stone in troubled thought.
"Peril comes in the night when least expected," he said. "We've had a narrow escape."
"How is the hobbit, Pippin?" asked Aragorn.
"I think all will be well now," answered Gandalf. "He was not held long, and hobbits have an amazing power of recovery. The memory, or the horror of it, will probably fade quickly, too quickly, perhaps. Will you, Aragorn, take the Orthanc stone and guard it? It's a dangerous charge."
"Dangerous indeed, but not to all," said Aragorn. "There's one who may claim it by right. For this assuredly is the Palantir of Orthanc, from the treasury of Elendil, set here by the kings of Gondor. Now my hour draws near. I will take it."
Gandalf looked at Aragorn, and then, to the surprise of the others, he lifted the covered stone and bowed as he presented it.
"Receive it, Lord," he said, "in earnest of other things that shall be given back. But if I may counsel you in the use of your own, don't use it yet. Be wary."
"When have I been hasty or unwary, who have waited and prepared for so many years?" asked Aragorn.
"Never yet."
"Don't then stumble at the end of the road," answered Gandalf. "But at the least keep this thing secret, you and all others that stand here. The hobbit, Peregrine, above all, should not know where it is bestowed. The evil fit may come on him again, for alas, he's handled it and looked in it, as should never have happened. He ought never to have touched it in Isengard, and there I should have been quicker. But my mind was bent on Saruman, and I didn't at once guess the nature of the stone. Then I was weary, and as I lay pondering it, sleep overcame me. Now I know."
"Yes, there can be no doubt," said Aragorn. "At last we know the link between Isengard and Mordor, and how it worked. Much is explained."
"Strange powers have our enemies, and strange weaknesses," said Theoden. "But it has long been said, oft evil will shall evil mar."
"That many times is seen," said Gandalf. "But at this time we have been strangely fortunate. Maybe I've been saved by this hobbit from a grave blunder. I'd considered whether or not to probe this stone myself to find its uses. Had I done so, I should have been revealed to him myself. I'm not ready for such a trial, if indeed I shall ever be so. But even if I found the power to withdraw myself, it would be disastrous for him to see me. Yet, until the hour comes when secrecy will avail no longer..."
"That hour is now come, I think," said Aragorn.
"Not yet," said Gandalf. "There remains a short while of doubt, which we must use. The enemy, it is clear, thought that the stone was in Orthanc. Why should he not? And that therefore the hobbit was captive there, driven to look in the glass for his torment by Saruman. That dark mind will be filled now with the voice and face of the hobbit and with expectation. It may take some time before he learns his error. We must snatch that time. We've been too leisurely. We must move. The neighbourhood of Isengard is no place to linger in. I will ride ahead at once with Peregrine Took. It will be better for him than lying in the dark while others sleep."
"I will keep Eomer and 10 riders," said the king. "They shall ride with me at early day. The rest may go with Aragorn and ride as soon as they have a mind."
"As you will," said Gandalf. "But make all the speed you may to the cover of the hills, to Helm's Deep."
At that moment a shadow fell over them. The bright moonlight seemed to be suddenly cut off. Several of the riders cried out and crouched, holding their arms above their heads, as if to ward off a blow from above. A blind fear and a deadly cold fell on them. Cowering, they looked up. A vast winged shape passed over the moon like a black cloud. It wheeled and went north, flying at a speed greater than any wind of Middle-earth. The stars fainted before it. It was gone. They stood up, rigid as stones. Gandalf was gazing up, his arms out and downwards, stiff, his hands clenched.
"Nazgul," he cried, "the messenger of Mordor, the storm is coming. The Nazgul have crossed the river. Ride, ride. Wait not for the dawn. Let not the swift wait for the slow. Ride. He sprang away, calling Shadowfax as he ran. Aragorn followed him. Going to Pippin, Gandalf picked him up in his arms. "You shall come with me this time," he said. "Shadowfax shall show you his paces." Then he ran to the place where he had slept. Shadowfax stood there ready. Slinging the small bag, which was all his luggage, across his shoulders, the wizard leapt upon the horse's back. Aragorn lifted Pippin and set him in Gandalf's arms, wrapped in cloak and blanket. "Farewell! Follow fast!" cried Gandalf. "Away, Shadowfax!" The great horse tossed his head. His flowing tail flicked in the moonlight. Then he leapt forward, spurning the earth, and was gone like the north wind from the mountains.
"A beautiful, restful night," said Merry to Aragorn. "Some folk have wonderful luck. He didn't want to sleep, and he wanted to ride with Gandalf, and there he goes, instead of being turned into a stone himself to stand here for ever as a warning.
If you had been the first to lift the Orthanc stone, and not he, how would it be now?" said Aragorn. "You might have done worse. Who can say? But now it's your luck to come with me, I fear. At once, go and get ready, and bring anything that Pippin left behind. Make haste."
Over the plains Shadowfax was flying, needing no urging and no guidance. Less than an hour had passed, and they had reached the fords of Isen and crossed them. The mound of the riders and its cold spears lay grey behind them.
Pippin was recovering. He was warm, but the wind in his face was keen and refreshing. He was with Gandalf. The horror of the stone and of the hideous shadow over the moon was fading. Things left behind in the mists of the mountains or in a passing dream. He drew a deep breath.
"I didn't know you rode bareback, Gandalf," he said. "You haven't a saddle or a bridle."
"I don't ride elf fashion except on Shadowfax," said Gandalf. "But Shadowfax will have no harness. You don't ride Shadowfax. He's willing to carry you or not." "If he's willing, that's enough. It's then his business to see that you remain on his back unless you jump off into the air."
"How fast is he going?" asked Pippin.
"Fast by the wind, but very smooth. And how light his footfalls are!"
"He's running now as fast as the swiftest horse could gallop," answered Gandalf. "But that is not fast for him. The land is rising a little here, and is more broken than it was beyond the river. But see how the white mountains are drawing near under the stars. Yonder are the three Heron peaks like black spears. It will not be long before we reach the branching roads and come to the Deeping Coombe, where the battle was fought 2 nights ago."
Pippin was silent again for a while. He heard Gandalf singing softly to himself, murmuring brief snatches of rhyme in many tongues as the miles ran under them. At last the wizard passed into a song of which the hobbit caught the words. A few lines came clearly to his ears through the rushing of the wind.
"Tall ships and tall kings, 3 times 3, what brought they from the founded land over the flowing sea? 7 stars and 7 stones, and 1 white tree.
"What are you saying, Gandalf?" asked Pippin.
"I was just running over some of the rhymes of lore in my mind," answered the wizard. "Hobbits, I suppose, have forgotten them, even those that they ever knew."
"No, not all," said Pippin. "And we have many of our own, which wouldn't interest you, perhaps. But I've never heard this one. What is it about, the 7 stars and 7 stones?
"About the palantiri of the kings of old," said Gandalf.
"What are they?"
"The name meant that which looks far away. The Orthanc stone was one."
"Then it was not made, not made?" Pippin hesitated. "By the enemy?"
"No," said Gandalf, "nor by Saruman. It's beyond his art, and beyond Sauron's too. The palantiri came from beyond Westernus, from Eldamar. The Noldor made them. Fëanor himself, maybe, wrought them, in days so long ago that the time cannot be measured in years. But there's nothing that Sauron cannot turn to evil uses. Alas for Saruman, it was his downfall, as I now perceive. Perilous to us all are the devices of an art deeper than we possess ourselves. Yet he must bear the blame. Fool to keep it secret, for his own profit. No word did he ever speak of it to any of the council. We hadn't yet given thought to the fate of the Palantiri of Gondor in its ruinous wars. By men they were almost forgotten. Even in Gondor they were a secret known only to a few. In Arnor they were remembered only in a rhyme of lore among the Dunedain.
"What did the men of old use them for?" asked Pippin, delighted and astonished at getting answers to so many questions, and wondering how long it would last.
"To see far off, and to converse in thought with one another," said Gandalf. "In that way they long guarded and united the realm of Gondor. They set up stones at Minas Anor, and at Minas Ithil, and at Orthonk in the Ring of Isengard. The chief and master of these was under the dome of Stars of Osgiliath before its ruin. The three others were far away in the north. In the house of Elrond it's told that they were at Annúmenas and Amonsul, and Elendil's stone was on the tower hills that look towards Mithlond in the Gulf of Lune, where the grey ships lie. Each Palantir applies to each, but all those in Gondor were ever open to the view of Osgiliath. Now it appears that, as the rock of Orthonk has withstood the storms of time, so there the Palantir of that tower has remained. But alone it could do nothing but see small images of things far off and days remote. Very useful, no doubt, that was to Saruman. Yet it seems that he was not content. Further and further abroad he gazed, until he cast his gaze upon Barad-dûr. Then he was caught.
Who knows where the lost stones of Arnor and Gondor now lie, buried or drowned deep? But one at least Sauron must have obtained and mastered to his purposes. I guess it was the Ithil stone, for he took Minas Ithil long ago and turned it into an evil place. Minas Morgul it has become.
Easy it is now to guess how quickly the roving eye of Saruman was trapped and held, and how ever since he has been persuaded from afar, and daunted when persuasion would not serve. The biter bit, the hawk under the eagle's foot, the spider in a steel web. How long, I wonder, has he been constrained to come often to his glass for inspection and instruction, and the Orthonk stone so bent towards Barad-dûr that, if any save a will of adamant now looks into it, it will bear his mind and sight swiftly thither. And how it draws one to itself! Have I not felt it? Even now my heart desires to test my will upon it, to see if I could not wrench it from him and turn it where I would, to look across the wide seas of water and of time to Tirion the Fair, and perceive the unimaginable hand and mind of Fëanor at their work, while both the white tree and the golden were in flower. He sighed and fell silent.
"I wish I'd known all this before," said Pippin. "I had no notion of what I was doing."
"Oh, yes, you had," said Gandalf. "You knew you were behaving wrongly and foolishly, and you told yourself so, though you didn't listen. I didn't tell you all this before, because it's only by musing on all that has happened that I've at last understood, even as we ride together. But if I'd spoken sooner, it wouldn't have lessened your desire or made it easier to resist. On the contrary, no, the burned hand teaches best. After that, advice about fire goes to the heart."
"It does," said Pippin. "If all the seven stones were laid out before me now, I should shut my eyes and put my hands in my pockets."
"Good," said Gandalf. "That is what I hoped."
"But I should like to know," Pippin began.
"Mercy," cried Gandalf. "If the giving of information is to be the cure of your inquisitiveness, I shall spend all the rest of my days in answering you. What more do you want to know?"
"The names of all the stars, and of all living things, and the whole history of Middle-earth, and over heaven, and of the sundering seas," laughed Pippin. "Of course, what less? But I'm not in a hurry tonight. At the moment I was just wondering about the Black Shadow. I heard you shout, 'Messenger of Mordor.' What was it? What could it do at Isengard?"
"It was a black rider on wings, a Nazgul," said Gandalf. "It could have taken you away to the Dark Tower."
"But it wasn't coming for me, was it?" faltered Pippin. "I mean, it didn't know that I had—"
"Of course not," said Gandalf. It is 200 leagues or more in straight flight from Barad-dûr to Orthanc, and even a Nazgûl would take a few hours to fly between them. But Saruman certainly looked in the stone since the Orc raid, and more of his secret thought, I do not doubt, has been read than he intended. A messenger has been sent to find out what he's doing, and after what has happened to-night another will come, I think, and swiftly. So Saruman will come to the last pinch of the vice that he has put his hand in. He has no captive to send. He has no stone to see with, and cannot answer the summons. Saruman will only believe that he is withholding the captive and refusing to use the stone. It will not help Saruman to tell the truth to the messenger, for Isengard may be ruined, yet he is still safe in Orthanc. So, whether he will or no, he will appear a rebel. Yet he rejected us, so as to avoid that very thing. What he will do in such a plight, I cannot guess. He has power still, I think, while in Orthanc, to resist the Nine Riders. He may try to do so. He may try to trap the Nazgûl, or at least to slay the thing on which it now rides the air. In that case, let Rohan look to its horses. But I can't tell how it will fall out, well or ill for us. It may be that the counsels of the enemy will be confused, or hindered by his wrath with Saruman. It may be that he will learn that I was there, and stood upon the stairs of Orthanc, with hobbits at my tail, or that an heir of Elendil lives and stood beside me. If Wormtongue was not deceived by the armour of Rohan, he would remember Aragorn and the title that he claimed. That is what I fear. And so we fly, not from danger, but into greater danger. Every stride of Shadowfax bears you nearer to the land of shadow, Peregrine Took. Pippin made no answer, but clutched his cloak, as if a sudden chill had struck him. Grey land passed under them. See now, said Gandalf, the Westfold dales are opening before us. Here we come back to the eastward road. The dark shadow yonder is the mouth of the Deeping Combe. That way lies Aglarond and the Glittering Caves. Don't ask me about them. Ask Gimli if you meet again, and for the first time you may get an answer longer than you wish. You'll not see the caves yourself, not on this journey. Soon they will be far behind.
I thought you were going to stop at Helm's Deep, said Pippin. Where are you going, then?
To Minas Tirith, before the seas of war surround it.
Oh, and how far is that?
Leagues upon leagues, answered Gandalf. Thrice as far as the dwellings of King Theoden, and they are more than 100 miles east from here, as the messengers of Mordor fly. Shadowfax must run a longer road, which will prove the swifter. We shall ride now till daybreak, and that is some hours away. Then even Shadowfax must rest, in some hollow of the hills. At Edoras, I hope. Sleep, if you can. You may see the first glimmer of dawn upon the golden roof of the House of Eorl. And in 2 days thence you shall see the purple shadow of Mount Mindoluin, and the walls of the Tower of Denethor white in the morning. Away now, Shadowfax! Run, Greatheart! Run as you have never run before! Now we are come to the lands where you were foaled, and every stone you know. Run now! Hope is in speed! Shadowfax tossed his head and cried aloud, as if a trumpet had summoned him to battle. Then he sprang forward. Fire flew from his feet. Night rushed over him. As he fell slowly into sleep, Pippin had a strange feeling. He and Gandalf were still as stone, seated upon the statue of a running horse, while the world rolled away beneath his feet with a great noise of wind.
Book 4 Chapter 1 The Taming of Smeagol.
"Well, master, we're in a fix and no mistake," said Sam Gamgee. He stood despondently with hunched shoulders beside Frodo and peered out with puckered eyes into the gloom. It was the third evening since they'd fled from the company, as far as they could tell. They had almost lost count of the hours during which they had climbed and laboured among the barren slopes and stones of the Emyn Muil, sometimes retracing their steps because they could find no way forward, sometimes discovering that they had wandered in a circle
back to where they had been hours before. Yet on the whole they had worked steadily eastward, keeping as near as they could find a way to the outer edge of this strange twisted knot of hills. But always they found its outward faces sheer, high and impassable, frowning over the plain below. Beyond its tumbled skirts lay livid, festering marshes, where nothing moved and not even a bird was to be seen. The hobbit stood now on the brink of a tall cliff, bare and bleak, its feet wrapped in mist, and behind them rose the broken highlands, crowned with drifting cloud. A chill wind blew from the east. Night was gathering over the shapeless lands before them. The sickly green of them was fading to a sullen brown. Far away to the right, the Anduin, that had gleamed fitfully in sunbreaks during the day, was now hidden in shadow. But their eyes didn't look beyond the river, back to Gondor, to their friends, to the lands of men. South and east they stared, to where, at the edge of the oncoming night, a dark line hung, like distant mountains of motionless smoke. Every now and again a tiny red gleam far away flickered upwards on the rim of earth and sky.
"What a fix!" said Sam. "That's the one place in all the lands we've ever heard of that we don't want to see any closer, and that's the one place we're trying to get to, and that's just where we can't get, nohow. We've come the wrong way altogether, seemingly. We can't get down, and if we get down, we'll find all that green land a nasty bog, I'll warrant. Phew, can you smell it?" he sniffed at the wind.
"Yes, I can smell it," said Frodo, but he didn't move, and his eyes remained fixed, staring out towards the dark line and the flickering flame. "Mordor," he muttered under his breath. "If I must go there, I wish I could come there quickly and make an end." He shuddered. The wind was chilly and yet heavy with an odour of cold decay. "Well," he said, at last withdrawing his eyes, "we can't stay here all night, fix or no fix. We must find a more sheltered spot, and camp once more, and perhaps another day will show us a path."
"Or another and another and another," muttered Sam, "or maybe no day. We've come the wrong way."
"I wonder," said Frodo. "It's my doom, I think, to go to that shadow yonder, so that a way will be found. But will good or evil show it to me? What hope we had was in speed. Delay plays into the enemy's hands, and here I am, delayed. Is it the will of the Dark Tower that steers us? All my choices have proved ill. I should have left the company long before, and come down from the north, east of the river and of the Emyn Muil, and so over the hard of battle plain to the passes of Mordor. But now it isn't possible for you and me alone to find a way back, and the orcs are prowling on the east bank. Every day that passes is a precious day lost. I'm tired, Sam. I don't know what's to be done. What food have we got left?"
"Only those, what you call 'em, lembas, Mr. Frodo. A fair supply. But they're better than naught by a long bite. I never thought, though, when I first set tooth in them, that I should ever come to wish for a change. But I do now. A bit of plain bread and a mug, aye, half a mug, of beer would go down proper. I've lugged my cooking gear all the way from the last camp, and what use has it been? Naught to make a fire with for a start, and naught to cook, not even grass."
They turned away and went down into a stony hollow. The westering sun was caught into clouds, and night came swiftly. They slept as well as they could for the cold, turn and turn about, in a nook among great jagged pinnacles of weathered rock. At least they were sheltered from the easterly wind.
"Did you see them again, Mr. Frodo?" asked Sam, as they sat, stiff and chilled, munching wafers of lembas in the cold grey of early morning.
"No," said Frodo. "I've heard nothing and seen nothing for 2 nights now."
"Nor me," said Sam. "Grr, those eyes did give me a turn. But perhaps we've shaken him off at last, the miserable slinker. Gollum,
I'll give him gollop in his throat if ever I get my hands on his neck.
I hope you'll never need to, said Frodo. I don't know how he followed us, but it may be that he's lost us again, as you say.
In this dry, bleak land we can't leave many footprints, nor much scent, even for his snuffling nose.
I hope that's the way of it, said Sam. I wish we could be rid of him for good.
So do I, said Frodo, but he's not my chief trouble. I wish we could get away from these hills. I hate them. I feel all naked on the east side, stuck up here with nothing but the dead flats between me and that shadow yonder. There's an eye in it. Come on. We've got to get down today somehow.
But that day wore on, and when afternoon faded towards evening, they were still scrambling along the ridge and had found no way of escape. Sometimes in the silence of that barren country they fancied that they heard faint sounds behind them, a stone falling, or the imagined step of flapping feet on the rock. But if they halted and stood still listening, they heard no more. Nothing but the wind sighing over the edges of the stones. Yet even that reminded them of breath softly hissing through sharp teeth.
This ends Disc 8.